Good evening and welcome to this special Friday extended edition of the KRFP Evening Report for January 10th, 2020. On today's show, we'll hear from Democratic District 5 Senator David Nelson of Moscow, who'll talk about the prospects of the 2020 Idaho legislative session and react to some of the proposals by Republican Governor Brad Little and other Republicans. But first, this news. Idaho Health and Welfare Department officials announced today two children have died of the flu this flu season in the state, and they are investigating the death of a third child who had apparent flu-related symptoms. Most influenza deaths occur in older adults. Health and Welfare Public Health Division Director Dr. Christine Hahn said, "This flu strain appears to be impacting some children in Idaho heavily, and we want to make sure that Idahoans are taking precautions to stay safe this flu season." Officials for the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway say they are developing plans for removing a locomotive from the Kootenai River west of Bonner's Ferry. The derailment occurred due to a 10-foot deep landslide over the railway January 1st. Three locomotives went over an embankment, as well as six mostly empty rail cars. Nobody was injured. Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway Public Affairs Director Gus Malonis told the Bonner County Daily Bee the railroad is moving equipment into position to bring one of the three locomotives back onto the rails Monday. The locomotive in the water has about 1,900 gallons of diesel fuel in it, and crews are assessing how much fuel is in the river. Crews have placed booms in the river to recover leaked oil, but they have only gathered a small amount so far. A Spokane County Sheriff's deputy shot and killed a man in the backyard of a North Spokane home this morning following a short vehicle pursuit. Police say the man ran away on foot and did not follow commands when he turned and faced the deputy and put his hands in his pockets. According to the Spokane County Sheriff's Department, the incident occurred a little before 4 a.m. during an attempted traffic stop near the intersection of North Wall Street and West Weill Avenue. Spokane County Sheriff Ozzie Nezovich said the driver did not stop for the deputy, and the deputy pursued the driver for two blocks. Spokane County Sheriff's Department spokesperson Corporal Mark Gregory told the Spokesman Review website the vehicle went into the backyard of a residence. Gregory said, due to this rapidly evolving and dangerous situation, the lone deputy attempted to deploy his taser, but it did not work. A very short foot pursuit ensued into the backyard of a residence. Sheriff Nezovich said the deputy was then confronted by the subject again, who turned, reached into the pocket or the waistband of his pants. He refused to obey the deputy's commands. At that point, we know a shot was fired, the subject was struck, and the subject is deceased. The Spokane City Police Department will investigate the killing. The Washington Liquor and Cannabis Control Board has pledged to address cultural change in its enforcement policies after a report says the agency needs to focus on compliance incentives rather than punitive enforcement of cannabis rules. Washington Liquor and Cannabis Control Board Director Rick Garza said they will encourage cannabis businesses to comply with Washington's cannabis laws and will slow the enforcement process rather than handing out quick punishments when they discover violations. Garza said, "I think we have learned a lot in the last 5 years of regulating the industry, where it became very strict, to begin to move toward a system that, I'll just say, is less strict and more in working with the industry." According to the Spokesman Review, the board made the pledge at a public hearing in Olympia Wednesday, following the release of an independent report by the firm Hilliard Heinz of Chicago, which recommended to make the board, quote, be more prevention and compliance oriented. rather than focusing almost exclusively upon enforcement activities, unquote. According to agency data over the past 5 years, the Liquor and Cannabis Board issued 3,220 rules violations to cannabis licensees, which carry possible fines or suspended and canceled licenses. A third of the rules violations were written warnings. Agency data also said they issued 349 violation warnings to cannabis businesses in Spokane. Licensees said in interviews with Hilliard Heinz last summer, they felt board agents were sometimes too quick to punish rather than help with compliance. Some of them said they felt intimidated by certain enforcement officials. Former state legislator and former Liquor and Cannabis Control Board member Chris Marr, who now works as a consultant for the cannabis industry, said at the beginning some of the agents were conflicted about regulating what used to be an illegal drug. Marr said some of their agents had spent their whole careers trying to put marijuana producers out of business. He said he applauds the agency on its quick response to owners and lawmakers about perceived heavy-handedness. Marr said, "I think we are entering a period where there's a genuine desire on the part of the Liquor Control Board to move away from a punitive kind of law enforcement approach. It's easier in terms of resources and so on. We have to remember that we're dealing with an industry that had a lot of baggage come with it." Garza said, "We're going to look and revise that entire policy to be one that's more uniform, what I'd say is a softer approach. In other words, an approach that looks more like a khaki and polo shirt." Marr admitted Washington regulators were more draconian than other states who have legalized marijuana. He said, "We started with probably the most restrictive initiative that was passed nationwide to determine how this industry would be regulated." The board has scheduled a vote on the issue next month in Olympia. The Nez Perce School Board discussed the issue of dropping the Indians title from its longtime representative place as the Nez Perce School District's mascot. At last night's school board meeting, several of those who attended favored ending the use of the Indian mascot, and others told school officials to keep the moniker. According to the Lewiston Tribune, Nez Perce resident Jerry Elvin said at the meeting, "The issue is not limited to Nez Perce schools, which in 2014 opted to end using the imagery of a chief wearing a full feathered headdress following discussions with the Nez Perce Tribal Executive Committee. The Shoshone-Bannock tribes of southeastern Idaho recently asked Governor Brad Little and lawmakers to, quote, take a stand and establish state policy to prohibit public schools from using American Indian-based mascots." Elvin said Native Americans across the country for years, quote, have had stuff taken away from them. Elvin said the Indian mascot is not offensive to him, but he would defer to people who are not comfortable with the name. He said it's good courtesy to drop the name and be done with it, and that ends it right there. Supporters for keeping the name urged the school board to keep the Indians' nickname. Local resident Jim Miller expressed resentment at the tribes who are pushing for the change. Miller said, "The tribe keeps pounding on us more and more. It has to stop someplace. They will keep taking rights away from us." Thompson later provided two alternative suggestions for consideration, the Nez Perce Thunder and the Nez Perce Aggies. He said, "Let it go, not with hard feelings, but let's spend our attention in more appropriate ways. How much effort are we going to put into this thing?" Thompson said he favors Aggies, but he said his son told him the name makes Nez Perce people sound like a bunch of hillbillies. The discussion of the Nez Perce School District mascot comes as Republican Representative Chad Christensen of Ammon announced this week he plans to introduce a bill in the legislature to forbid local school boards from changing school mascots. According to the Teton Valley News, Christensen wrote on Facebook, "This is in response to Teton County abolishing the Redskin name. There is an agenda to destroy local heritage, so long-time residents no longer have an identity, and so generational traditions become extinct." Christensen said his bill would likely put mascot changes up for a citizen vote. The Teton School Board voted 4-1 in July to retire the Redskins mascot for their schools after a school board election showed local patrons were split on the issue. The Shoshone-Bannock tribe, whose ancestors were the original Teton Valley people, supported the retirement of the Redskins mascot. In a memo sent to faculty, staff, and students late last month, University of Idaho President C. Scott Green released his budget reduction targets for university departments to try to shore up the anticipated $22 million university deficit by 2022. Green has asked the university's information technology services and the university's provost units, which include academic programming, to reduce their costs by 13% and the Department of Finance and Administration and research units to reduce their costs by 12%, while Green's office would take an 8% budget cut. Green's memo said over 200 university employees have shown interest in retirement incentives and voluntary separation, but it's unknown how much money would be saved by that. Green wrote, "This represents more than $14.5 million, but is not necessarily salary savings, as some positions will need to be refilled. We also anticipated that not everyone expressing early interest in these programs will move forward with separation from the university." University of Idaho Communications Director Jody Walker said around 80% of the university's budget goes to salaries and benefits. Walker said the provost's unit's budget is the largest overall, and the 13% cut amounts to around $11.4 million in savings. She said the provost's budget supports more than academic programming, and cuts can be taken from other areas instead of programming. Walker told the Daily News, "Just because the provost's line says that it's a 13% reduction, that's not necessarily all just programs. That's people, that's programs, that's things outside of an academic program that a student might be involved in. Their budget is huge. Strategic enrollment management is within the provost's office, and a lot of support programs for academics are within the provost's office." Walker said vandal bookstore sales have been outsourced, which the university believes will save student money spent on books. She said President Green did not ask the university's marketing and communications, university advancement, and fundraising divisions to reduce their budgets because they support university growth and brought in $4.6 million in fundraising and $51 million in gifts last year. Walker said administrative salary reductions will be intentionally small because those positions ensure competent business management, and while those salaries are high in comparison to other university positions, they are a bit low compared to the salaries nearby institutions pay. Walker said, "If we underpay, all we're going to do is lose a position that we desperately need and not be able to refill it. If that position out in the world makes $150,000, we're not going to be able to pay somebody $90,000 to do the same job and have the same quality employee." Ada County prosecutors have charged former Idaho State Budget Director Martin Marty Peterson of Boise with an additional 11 child pornography charges following his arrest last October for sexual exploitation of a minor. The Idaho Statesman previously reported the Idaho Internet Crimes Against Children Unit, the Boise Police Department, the Ada County Prosecutor's Office, all participated in the investigation of the 76-year-old former state official and said Peterson accessed images of children 3 years old or younger. Prosecutors charged Peterson with three felony counts of accessing or viewing sexually explicit images of minors in October, and Ada County prosecutors amended that to add the 11 additional counts in December. Peterson was budget director for former Democratic governors John Evans and Cecil Andrus. He served on Republican Governor Butch Otter's transition team as Association of Idaho Cities Executive Director and as an assistant to several University of Idaho presidents. Peterson is a Lewiston native and University of Idaho graduate. He recently served on the University of Idaho's School of Journalism and Mass Media Advisory Board, the Friends of Idaho Public Television Board, and as president for the Foundation for Idaho History. The Moscow Transportation Commission unanimously supported a grant application yesterday to fund a roundabout at the intersection of West A and Baker Streets to improve safety for pedestrians and vehicles. The grant would come from the Idaho Local Highway Safety Improvement Program, which has awarded grants to Moscow in the past, including for the upcoming West 3rd and West 6th Street safety improvement projects. Moscow Senior Technician Nate Sir presented the idea to the commission yesterday at City Hall. According to an account of the meeting in the Daily News, Sir said the grant money is basically federal money for localities to improve safety. Sir said there have been two accidents involving pedestrians at the intersection of West A and Baker Streets in the last 5 years, which resulted in disabling injuries. Although there have been no fatal accidents at the intersection, Sir said 1% of all vehicle crashes, 7.5% of disabling injury crashes, and 8.5% of pedestrian crashes in the city occurred at the intersection. Cost estimates for the project are between $750,000 and $800,000, with the grant funding 92.66% of the project, with a local match of between $55,000 and $59,000. The project's design would include a roundabout in the center of the intersection with a raised traffic island to separate traffic going different directions. The raised or splitter island would slow traffic by narrowing the lanes. Sir said it's downhill on both directions and it's wide and people just blow through there. He said the wide islands would also serve as pedestrian refuges when crossing the intersection by splitting the crosswalk. Sir said some parking would be eliminated by the project. Washington State University is warning students returning to Pullman this weekend for the spring semester to use extreme caution when driving and recommending they not wait until Sunday to drive back due to a snowstorm expected to hit eastern Washington this weekend. The National Weather Service predicts additional snow accumulation Saturday and Sunday. In a Twitter message posted Wednesday, Washington State University advised students to access the National Weather Service and Washington Department of Transportation for weather and road condition updates before traveling. The Daily News reports Washington State University Assistant Police Chief Steve Hansen also advised students to expect hazardous weather and to travel with an emergency kit containing water, blankets, and extra cold weather clothing. Hansen said students who arrive earlier than Monday will have access to food services and student residences in Pullman. He said, although there were no collisions on the WSU campus yesterday, quote, today could be a different story. In a news release yesterday, the Washington State Patrol and National Weather Service recommended people stock extra emergency supplies, ensure their fireplaces are working properly, and fill their vehicles with gas. The release also advises those outdoors to wear appropriate layers of loose, lightweight winter clothing with hats and scarves, and to avoid driving if not necessary. The Washington Transportation Department advised drivers to slow down, not to use cruise control, and to leave additional space between vehicles and watch for snowplows. Washington State Patrol Trooper Jeff Savigny said drivers should give themselves extra time when traveling and should not use their cell phones and use common sense. Savigny said, take it easy and hopefully everybody arrives safely. Crews transported one person by helicopter and four others by ambulance to regional hospitals following a three-car collision yesterday, 10 miles south of Pullman on U.S. Route 195. The crash occurred about 6 p.m. yesterday evening, shutting down all three lanes of U.S. 195. The Daily News reports the Washington State Patrol, Whitman County Fire District 12 and 14, and Pullman and Lewiston ambulances responded to the scene. Whitman County Fire District Chief Lester Irwin said the vehicles had been towed and the highway cleared by around 8 p.m. Irwin said crews took three of the injured to Pullman Regional Hospital and two others to St. Joseph Regional Hospital in Lewiston. The Daily News website reported the injured were 52-year-old Raul Espinosa of Pullman, 55-year-old Mary Teachin of Colton, and 30-year-old Rachel Teachin of Colton. Crews transported three people to hospitals to be checked who were uninjured. They were 57-year-old Jeffrey Teachin of Colton, 32-year-old Lacey Fitzpatrick of Rathdrum, and a 2-year-old in the vehicle driven by Lacey Fitzpatrick. Providence Sacred Heart Medical Center unionized service and maintenance workers in Spokane reached a tentative contract agreement Wednesday. The agreement came the day after the nurses at the hospital, represented by the Washington State Nurses Association, reached an agreement with Providence. The service and maintenance workers are represented by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union 21. About 13,000 healthcare workers in the Providence system statewide had threatened to strike last week. The 13,000 workers are represented by Service Employees International Union Northwest 1199, United Food and Commercial Workers International Union 21, and the Washington State Nurses Association. United Food and Commercial Workers International Union 21 issued a statement saying, "This win was a result of the strong unity between UFCW 21, SEIU Healthcare 1199 Northwest, and the Washington State Nurses Association." The spokesman review reports two United Food and Commercial Workers International Union 21 bargaining units will now begin a round of negotiations with Providence for the workers they represent at Holy Family Hospital in Spokane. The union is also continuing contract negotiations with Providence on behalf of nurses they represent at Providence hospitals in Walla Walla, Centralia, and Olympia. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP thanks its donors and sponsors, including Hodgins Drug and Hobbies of 307 South Main Street in Moscow. Hodgins features a pharmacy, educational toys, and hobbies. Hodgins also sells and services hearing aids. You can call Hodgins at 208-882-5536.
This is the KRFP Evening Report. We now turn to our featured segment. Idaho Governor Brad Little gave his State of the State address Monday, proposing $35 million in grocery tax relief to remove half of the state's 6% sales tax on groceries, increasing the state's K-12 budget by 4.1% or $77.7 million, adding $3.2 million to the state's literacy initiative, increasing general fund allocations for state colleges and universities by 0.39%, increasing the road construction budget by 7.9%, and increasing the correction department budget by 12%, among other things. Here's a segment of Governor Little's State of the State address on Monday, including the part where he spoke about the education budget.
Still too many students across the state are falling behind. About 12,000 kindergartners are not on track to read when they show up on day one. My budget keeps our foot on the gas and makes our historic investment in literacy ongoing. The push for literacy was a recommendation that came out of my Our Kids, Idaho's Future Task Force. The task force was made up of teachers, school administrators, education stakeholders, business leaders, and a bipartisan group of legislators from every quarter of the state. I want to voice my appreciation to every member of the task force for taking on this important job, especially the co-chairs, Debbie Critchfield and Bill Gilbert. Thank you very much. The task force also identified the need to continue to investing in teachers. A child's progress in all subjects, especially reading, depends upon the intention and instruction of a good teacher. We cannot simply rely on the good hearts of teachers any longer to retain an effective teaching workforce in Idaho. We must pay them competitively. Your property. Your property taxes shoulder a growing share of teachers' salaries and operating expenses in our school districts. It's out of balance and it's not sustainable. I propose we put an additional $30 million in ongoing general fund as a down payment to continue increasing teacher pay over the next several years. Performance criteria will ensure accountability. These investments have been ongoing the past several years, and I commend the legislature for stepping up to support our educators. Our efforts should elevate the profession and help us keep good teachers in Idaho classrooms. Idaho has experienced tremendous growth in recent years, but nationally and internationally, the pace of economic growth is expected to slow. Last fall, I asked all state entities that receive general funds to undergo a spending reset, except for my highest priority area, public education. The time to prepare for a potential downturn is now, when times are good. The spending reset also focuses a closer examination of spending. We cannot lose our focus on the taxpayer. A former JFAC co-chair, my dad, stated the easiest thing to do is spend other people's money. I understand it's difficult for state agencies and our universities to tighten things up, but it must be done habitually and willingly because it's the right thing to do. My budget leaves an appropriate cash balance, shores up our rainy day funds, which has helped us weather economic storms that forced other states to raise taxes. Idaho's ranked in the top 10 states nationally for the balance of our state budget reserves, but a credible stress test shows we have more work to do to prepare for a recession. That's why I'm also calling for us to raise the cap on our main rainy day fund so that we can better position our state for any economic condition.
That was Republican Idaho Governor Brad Little giving the State of the State address Monday. In an interview this afternoon with KRFP, Democratic State Senator David Nelson of Moscow said he can get behind some of the governor's initiatives, but he said, unfortunately, it's probably going to be a put out the fire type of legislative session.
It's an election year, so there's going to be lots of posturing going on, and you've seen that already. Like Chad Christensen has a fully guns in schools, you know, just walk into school with a gun, no problem. That bill's come out already. So I think there'll be lots of fires. I mean, the governor, I think, has got fairly good intentions on where to put incremental money. And I think that's those kind of initiatives I can get behind on doing that. There's also infrastructure issues that I think we'll make a little bit of progress on roads, for example. There's some extra spending authority the governor already's got worked out. The thing called the surplus eliminator, which allows us to spend surplus money on road projects, probably is, well, it has come back as basically their first bill in the session. And I need to look at the fine print on what they've done on that, but I think that's a bill that I can get behind. There is lots of talk about things like redistricting. I know the Republican leadership was pretty quiet about that when they were in Moscow a few weeks ago, but I'm already hearing that it's not just more districts, it's let's change the commission and make it a more partisan commission. So I think that's a fire we're going to have to deal with.
Yeah, that would be a constitutional amendment, right, in order to change that. And basically they want to change it so three elected statewide officials, that would mean Republicans, choose the tie-breaking member of the redistricting commission instead of having an even number of six people on the commission that meets every 10 years to draw legislative district lines. There would be a seventh person, and that would almost invariably be a Republican in the current political climate. And then, of course, the Republicans would continue to have power because they'd be drawing the district lines. So gerrymandering, it's bringing back gerrymandering, right?
It's bringing back gerrymandering. You know, really, we have a system that's the envy of most states. It's not a nonpartisan, but it's a bipartisan commission. Half the folks are appointed by the Democrats and half by the Republicans. They can't be elected officials, and they have to forswear from running for the legislature for 5 years after their service. And since it's 50-50, they have to settle. They have to compromise. They have to find a way to compromise. So why we would change something that's the envy of the nation, I don't get. But I guess the Republicans with 80% of the seats, they somehow want to get up to 100%. It's not really rational. The process to do that is it takes both houses of the legislature have to pass a joint resolution. And resolutions like that take a two-thirds vote in the body. So it's not a easy thing to pass.
And then it goes before the voters of Idaho, right?
It does. But I mean, I think the best place to stop this is really in the state Senate. Because with seven Democrats and four Republicans can stop it. So that's I think that's the first best place to stop that kind of an effort. But if it does get through the legislature, the governor has no say in it, so that's a constitutional amendment, and we just all get to vote on it next fall if it goes through. And it's, you know, it could be different than the way you described. Maybe they would put two more people on there or have some totally different mechanism to appoint members. What you described was the bill that briefly came up last year.
Right. Is C. Scott Groh the likely person to provide the legislature with this constitutional amendment proposal this time?
Senators? I don't think so. I only hear about this from the House side. So I would think it's somebody from the House State Affairs Committee. I think Steve Harris from Boise was the person who brought that forth last year. But I hear, you know, Speaker Moyle or Speaker Bedke and the Majority Leader Moyle, they all are talking about it.
Okay, and from what I have been reading is all the other states that have made reforms to cut back on gerrymandering have not gone back. So Idaho would be the first state to reverse that. Of course, the current system of redistricting commissions have been in effect, I think, since the 80s for quite a long time in Idaho.
It's been quite a long time. You know, the real distinction among the states is states where the legislature does it themselves. And that's where you have a really true mess, and you end up in lawsuits for 10 years after redistricting. North Carolina is one of those states, and they had to redraw their lines even one more time this year. A lot of the western states, like Idaho, have these redistricting commissions where you have citizens rather than the legislature doing it. And truthfully, I can't imagine Idaho dumping the redistricting commission. You know, we might make it much more partisan, but I don't think the commission's going anywhere.
Well, even as it stands now, legislators do choose the citizen members of the commission. For example, doesn't the House Speaker choose one, and the Majority Leader in the Senate choose one, and then you have the Minority Leaders choose one? Is that how it works?
Yeah, each of the majority and minority leadership in each body has an appointment, and then the head of each political party in Idaho also has appointments. Those are the fifth and sixth appointments are from the parties.
Yeah, sounds like it's designed only for a two-party system.
For sure, only two parties. I mean, the statutes talk about the two largest parties, so it's always going to be a two-party-oriented system.
Okay, and you had something else to say about that?
I guess I just reacting to I don't think other states have gone backwards in being more more partisan in the way they do these. Other states, like I think California, has a really totally nonpartisan system that they use. That would be interesting. I think it's even like you pick people apply and they like get picked out of a lottery to go work on it. So that's a different mechanism. Our system does have the appointees tend to have a political twist on things because of the way they're appointed.
Okay, and I just remembered what Senator C. Scott Grow was behind last year during the legislative session. Another thing that seems to diminish democracy, and this wouldn't, I don't think, would be a constitutional amendment. I think it's just legislation to essentially take the state initiative process away from people who want to gather signatures. By reducing the length of time to gather signatures, increasing the number of signatures, or increasing the number of legislative districts that supply a minimum number of signatures. It seems like the minimum wage and the legal medical marijuana initiatives are just scaring legislators. Like, the people don't have the right to regulate themselves that way.
Yeah, I would expect some anti-initiative bill to come forward again. I'm not sure if it'll be from Grow or from somebody else, but I think we'll have that battle to fight. And it's too bad, because every time the citizens decide they have to take some of this power back into their own hands, when the legislature won't deal with something like Medicaid expansion, the legislature likes to make it harder. I mean, that's what happened with the Luna Law bills. What was that, 10 years ago, where we repealed all the education reform laws from Tom Luna.
And then the legislature made it harder to get initiatives on the ballot after that.
Legislature made it, yeah. And really, if you compare us to other states, we're pretty darn hard already. I mean, 5% of the voters who voted in the last election is a pretty big number. The number of legislative districts that have to meet that threshold is it 20? I think
it's half of them plus one, so 18.
So you know, those are all hard things, I heard a talk once about the way our redistricting is, and that requirement on legislative districts is on pretty flimsy legal ground as it is, because it's really kind of violating one man, one vote, right? You're saying that people in different, you know, a number of legislative districts kind of have a veto on things. So if we up that number higher, I think it could easily get thrown out in court. Again, and the process to do this, it's just written in statute, so the legislature can totally do it next year. Or this year, and hopefully we'd have Governor Little with us, who vetoed the bill that came through last year. That's the only way it was stopped, was when Governor Little vetoed it near the end of the session.
Right, he thought it might be a big court fight. Was one of the excuses.
I think so. Well, and the other thing people kind of forget about is when you make it harder and harder, the only possible way to do it is with a lot of money and a lot of paid signature gatherers going out. So think about marijuana. If you really don't want marijuana, is this what you want to do? I mean, you're liable to have a big national company or international company that's trying to sell marijuana, and they want to come into the state, and they'll have the bucks to go out and do that initiative. So it doesn't, you know, if you're afraid of marijuana legalization, I think this is not going to help you.
Okay, interesting. So you were mentioning transportation changes. I know Representative Palmer over in the House The head of the Transportation Committee has introduced legislation to change, to I guess create an endowment fund that would accrue interest, and then the interest would be used for road projects. And you mentioned the surplus eliminator. Maybe you could explain those things, and if you feel Representative Palmer's approach is appropriate.
Sure. So they're kind of two. What the surplus eliminator that we've had in the state and Representative Palmer's bill are kind of two ways to accomplish the same thing. And what that is to use some extra general fund monies that might not be available year in, year out, and steer that extra money to transportation. Because we have the reason we want to do that is because we have about $400 million in deficit in our transportation infrastructure. About half of that is just maintenance on our existing roads, and about half of that is safety and capacity projects that we're just not getting done. So the two different ways people have tried to do this is the old surplus eliminator, which just basically said any surplus left over at the end of the year after a couple of special cases, half of that money will go to transportation projects. And when the economy's been good in the last 5 or 6 years, we've been spending off, you know, $30, $40 million a year, okay? So it doesn't fix the hole by any means, but it helps. And you can go around Latah County and see civic bridges that we've got fixed because we had that money, and projects on roads in Moscow because we had that money. I think in particular, like the Third Street redo to make it more bike usable came with some of that money. So that's one way. We just take half the surplus. Representative Palmer's approach and others in the House is actually to take our budget stabilization funds, which are our rainy day funds. They're money we've got socked away in case there's a recession and our income drops in the state. And rather than having to totally cut the budgets, we can tap into those rainy day funds. And the way we have them structured now, they don't really make very much interest. They're very, very conservatively invested. Think your checking account. And so we have, you know, essentially $500 million sitting out there not generating interest. And in a nutshell, Palmer's approach is to take that money, any money we have in the budget, in our piggy bank for emergencies, and we'll take the interest off that, and we'll invest it a little bit more, less conservatively, so there is interest, and then that money would go towards transportation. And with a $500 million emergency fund, that spins off about $20 or $25 million a year for transportation projects. Again, it's only going to be when the economy is good, because if we can't keep the fund filled, the first take is to go back to it. If we're having to spend down those emergency fund money, the whole thing goes away until we build it back up. So it's, you know, it really puts transportation at the back of the line. I'm probably okay with either method of doing these. I do like the idea of doing the budget, doing a better job of utilizing those emergency monies. And since Idaho likes to have quite a big, healthy emergency fund, I would expect that to be there, as long as the economy's good.
Yeah, as long as you can get interest on those investments.
Right. It does. We do lose some money for transportation going that way, just because the surpluses have been historically bigger than the interest that would spin off on that. So it has kind of taken a bit of a step backwards for transportation money, but it is a little bit more stable because, you know, on a year when there's no surplus, and this year we may not have any, then we wouldn't get anything. But if we had that money in the bank, and it may not be growing a whole lot, or it may not, we weren't tapping into it, no surplus, but we still had the interest to be gained. So it probably is more stable year in, year out.
Well, I remember a few years ago, the legislators were saying, well, we're continually digging a hole and getting further and further behind as far as road maintenance and I think improvements as well. Are we still digging a deeper hole as far as getting behind behind schedule on what our maintenance work should be?
Yeah, we are. The latest number I have seen is we're about $400 million a year combined behind. So we really, you know, this is, the surplus eliminators fiddling around the edges a little bit. And really that deficit is sort of twofold. One, we're pretty darn conservative in Idaho, so we don't want to spend money. But more importantly, our source of money for that is shrinking and will continue shrinking. Because if you think about road is almost entirely funded by use fees. Ordinarily.
Gas tax, you mean?
Yeah, gas tax and diesel tax. So, you know, really year in, year out, we give ourselves a tax cut on the gas tax just because our cars get more efficient. I don't know about you, but, you know, 10 years ago, I was driving cars that got, you know, 18 miles to the gallon, and now my car gets 28 miles to the gallon. So that, and I'm using the road just as much, but I'm paying really a third less in gas tax.
What about vehicle registration and license fees?
That comes into the picture too, but it's way less part of the, it's much less money that way. I think $100 registration fee increase, which I've heard a little talk about this year, would generate like $10 or $20 million, where the gas tax as a whole we're generating, I think, more than $1 billion a year. So, you know, so if you recognize that our gas tax is sort of going down, we need to, in the short term, we need to raise the gas tax again, because it's we're getting less of it and it's about buying power is going down. And in the medium term, we need to switch to or supplement it with something else like a mileage fee, right? Electric cars don't buy gas. So if we're going to properly do a usage fee on the vehicles out there, and they include electrics, which there are more and more of those, we need to get to a mileage fee. You know, electric trucks aren't that far off, especially for, you know, in town kind of things where large ranges aren't long, aren't quite the issue. So one of the side things I'm going to try to work with is to start to set the scene for putting in a mileage base tax so that we're ready as electrification comes along. Oregon has been a good example to this. They've actually just gone through a two-year study figuring out how to do it and testing it, and now they're rolling it out to all consumers in the state of Oregon.
And it seems we're always worried about road improvements and maintenance of roads, but there's also public transportation. Is the state going to change anything on that this year? Does most of the money for that come from the federal government, or how's that fit in?
Yeah, most of that's federal money. The one thing that's actually part of the surplus eliminator discussions is there's a $4.5 million chunk in, I think, in either of those bills that directs money for pedestrian and bike safety, especially for like walk to school routes kind of thing throughout the state. So we are trying to be more stable with a pot of money for those kind of things. And Moscow's got benefit from that. I also know that bike to school money we had from a couple years ago was involved in that Third Street project. So that little piece. I don't really expect a lot of other public transportation issues. There's a lot of demand for it down here in the Treasure Valley, but I don't hear a lot about it in our neck of the woods.
All right, let's move on to a few other issues before we wrap up. The governor's proposed education budget. What are your thoughts on the education budget? And then I'll ask a question about the tuition freeze and the universities.
Yeah, I think the governor's got his heart in the right place and directing more money for education. And he seems to be having to make lots of big trade-offs to get money for education. And I think it's pretty modest for what we're trying to do. I mean, I appreciate him for proposing $30 million more for experienced teacher salaries. Those are those very experienced teachers, sort of 20-plus years, who were not really included in any of the teacher salary funding in the last few years. We need to do it to keep and retain those folks, or they're going to leave. And they are leaving because we have a teacher shortage problem. But $30 million isn't enough. I heard somebody say today that this is fully funding the career ladder, which is this is part of by completing the experienced teachers, which was a 2013 governor's task force. At the rate we're going to do it, it won't be done until 2025. And will everybody have left by the time we do that? I mean, that's a way out of date recommendation. And the governor's also this year trying to save quite a bit of money, more money into our rainy day funds. And I'm just cringing against this because our economy is good right now. There's no hint of a recession anywhere in Idaho and really in the country. Population growth is high in Idaho. We're still in one of the top four or five in the country growing by per capita. So where is the problem that we have to, we have to do 2% holdbacks in everything but K-12 education? The only thing I can think of is, the 2017 tax cut was too big. And so we don't have our revenue stream shrunk with that. And here, even when the economy is good, it's not really good enough to incrementally fund education to where we want to do. And these pieces that the governor put in are great. I like literacy. I like teacher pay. But, we have on the order of 1,000 new students coming into the state of Idaho every year. And we're barely keeping up with that, even with these incremental monies. We need to do something bigger than this to do better in education.
And so it sounds like you believe that the tax relief bills of the last few years are the main reason we have these deficits, and that would include the at the universities. I guess the University of Idaho is going to have a $14 million deficit. I want to ask about the tuition freeze that just got announced. It's just a one-year tuition freeze for the universities and colleges. Does that signal that the university should be getting more general fund money?
I would have thought that would be the signal. That would be a signal that there was some deal done behind the scenes that they were going to get directed more money. But there is no significant higher ed increase in funding for higher ed in the governor's recommendations. And I don't hear anything coming out of the legislature for higher ed. I mean, we keep using higher ed as kind of a piggy bank when we need money somewhere else.
Senator Nelson, do you have any plans to introduce legislation this year?
So I'm working on one bill that's called a right to repair bill, and that helps folks who have a piece of electronic equipment, be it an iPhone or if you're a farmer, the tractors and combines are all very electronic now. It helps them get them repaired without having to go to the dealer. Right now, often if your phone or your combine breaks, your only option is to go to Apple or go to John Deere and get it fixed, and that it can be quite pretty expensive. And this bill puts some protections in that lets people go to an independent repair shop, and that independent repair shop would have access to parts and documentation and training and the diagnostic equipment they'd have.
That sounds like a wonderful idea. I'd I've definitely worried about that in the last few years. Okay, any other promising things from a progressive point of view in the legislature? Any of your Democratic colleagues introducing interesting legislation?
I think there's going to be several, at least a couple different efforts on both mandatory minimums and then also decriminalizing some things. You know, there's a lot of things that we criminalize that you do in your home or, you know, that really have no public input pact and they can turn into a felony, and maybe we turn those into misdemeanors or citations instead of a felony. I think there may be some progress on that. We're proposing legislation to help with property taxes. I'm sure you hear around people here around Moscow that the property taxes have gone up a lot. And a lot of that has to do with a shift in taxes because residential property values are going up at a much higher rate than any other category of property. And so we end up paying more of the share of the property tax. And so the homestead exemption, we'd like to index that and raise it, to raise it and then index it to inflation. So as our housing prices go up, that would help with the tax shift a bit. There's another thing called the circuit breaker that helps elderly folks, unlimited income. I think those are the two main property tax issues, things we're pushing forward. I think we just got to be careful on property taxes in the legislature, not to harm our counties and cities and schools, because we can wave our hands down and the legislature and scream and yell about property taxes, but the state of Idaho doesn't use it. It's only our local entities that utilize property taxes, and if we take it away because it's not working well, we sure better find a way to replace it, or we'll have even less money for schools and less money for our cities and our counties.
Does anything have to be done with Medicaid expansion this year?
Yes, we have to settle on a funding mechanism this year, and it costs about $40 million a year from the state to fund it. That's the state's share. And about a little more than half of that can be paid for just from savings. Because if somebody's on Medicaid, we don't have to pay for the service a different way. And then how to come up with that other $20 million is the question. The governor's proposing that we take $12 million out of what's called the Millennium Fund, which is the old tobacco settlement. And I think that's an okay idea for a few years, because it's a big fund. It's on the order of $400 million in the endowment, I think. So we can afford that a little bit. It shouldn't be in the long term, because that really should be, that was the intention of that fund, was for addiction kind of treatment.
And of course, just to review, the state is paying for 10% of Medicaid expansion and the federal government's paying 90%.
That's right. Thanks for reminding me that, Lee. So the other $8 million, the governor's proposing we claw that back from the counties, because the counties have savings on their, all the counties have to pay for the first $10,000 of any indigent care claim, and so they will have savings. I would prefer not to do it that way. It's not clear what the savings are going to be in the counties until we really achieve that. I guess I'd rather have some mechanism that you know, as counties achieve savings, they somehow pay that back to the state. But, you know, really, here's something else we did last year. We added a sales tax to all internet sales. It's based on what's called the Wayfair decision. And so now we're collecting a lot more sales tax when you buy anything online. And in the first half of the year, we collected $32 million from that new tax.
That goes into a special fund, correct?
Yeah, it's what it's called. It's called the Tax Relief Fund. Okay, so it's going in there for another tax cut. And it's like, why don't we just use $20 million of that to pay for Medicaid expansion and be done with it and quit arguing. So And there, and people have other ideas for that fund, but it shouldn't be that, you know, if we're going to collect sales tax from our citizens, we shouldn't be sitting on it and having it be some legislator's essentially slush fund, which is what the House leadership wants to do with that fund, to do, you know, to issue a property, to issue a tax cut in an election year. They're trying to save up money for that. Let's have a useful purpose for that, either roads or pay for Medicaid expansion or push the money forward to schools. Let's just not sit on it.
Didn't Governor Little mention something about using at least some of that money for Medicaid expansion during his State of the State address, or am I mishearing him?
Slightly different. He wants to use about $30 million of that to decrease the sales tax on groceries. So I think $30 million would buy us an increase. Right now there is a tax credit every citizen in the state gets for buying groceries. It's like $75 or $100 a person drug tax credit. And so I think that $30 million he wants to use out of that would increase that tax credit by, I think that's about a 20 or 30% increase in that.
And if somebody doesn't make enough money to bother with state income taxes, then they're just going to spend their money on groceries and pay the taxes and not get the tax credit.
No, it's actually what's called a refundable tax credit. So even if you don't file, if you don't make enough money to file taxes, you can file a form and they will, and the state will send you the money.
Oh.
So everybody gets it.
Well, we'll have to remind people to do that at tax time. Anything else you'd like to add, Senator Nelson, as we close down the interview?
I guess I just would like to thank the citizens of District 5, Layton, Benoit County, for electing me. I appreciate their support and advice, and I appreciate everybody's thanks and best wishes they're always telling me. It is stressful, but it is an honor to serve down here, and I appreciate the trust people have put in me. And if they need to reach me about an issue, they can look me up on the internet and send me an email or call me. I'd be happy to talk and respond to any issue.
That was Democratic Idaho State Senator David Nelson of Moscow, who represents District 5, which is Latah and Benoit County, speaking with KRFP this afternoon. The Idaho legislative session for 2020 started on Monday. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, the National Weather Service has a winter storm warning in effect until 10 a.m. tomorrow. Heavy snow shifting into Idaho and the eastern third of Washington this evening. Moderate to heavy snow will continue to impact the Idaho Panhandle and the eastern reaches of Washington through the evening hours. Snow showers will continue in the northeastern mountains of Washington and the Idaho Panhandle through Saturday. Heavy snow expected for the Washington and Idaho Palouse, including Moscow, Plummer, Potlatch, Genesee, Pullman, Colfax, Rosalia, La Crosse, Oaksdale, Tico, and Uniontown. Total snow accumulation 6 to 10 inches, with the highest amounts in Idaho. Winds gusting up to 25 miles an hour. Travel could be very difficult to impossible. Blowing snow could significantly reduce visibility and result in local areas of drifting snow. The hazardous conditions will impact the evening commute. If you must travel, keep an extra flashlight, food, and water in your vehicle in case of an emergency. The forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area is calling for snow could be heavy at times, low 31. Total nighttime snow accumulation 3 to 5 inches. Tomorrow, 90% chance of snow showers, new accumulation 2 to 4 inches, high 34. 60% chance of precipitation Saturday night, snow showers likely mainly before 10 p.m., then snow likely after 4 a.m., patchy blowing snow, cloudy low 30 and breezy, southwest winds 10 to 20, gusts up to 35 miles an hour. New snow accumulation Saturday night, 1 to 3 inches. On Sunday, 3 to 7 inches of new snow possible. 90% chance of precipitation, patchy blowing snow before 10 a.m., high 35, South winds 10 to 15, gusts up to 20. On Sunday night, 70% chance of precipitation. New snow accumulation 2 to 4 inches possible. Snow likely mainly before 10 p.m. Patchy blowing snow after 2 a.m. Cloudy, low 23. Breezy, southwest winds 15 to 20. Gusts up to 30 miles per hour. On Monday, 40% chance of snow. Patchy blowing snow after 4 p.m. Cloudy, high 27. Blustery, new snow accumulation less than 1 inch possible. And there's lower percent chances of snow Monday night into Tuesday night with temperatures going down. Monday night's low will be around 13 and Tuesday night's low around 6. The Washington Department of Transportation road condition report in real time says U.S. Highway 95 in both directions between Rosalia through Pullman and down to the state line is a moderate impact. Motorists may encounter reduced visibility in places, and there's a snow-covered roadway. Also, snow-covered roadway on Interstate 90 and other roads in the area. The Idaho 511 road condition map reports that there is difficult driving conditions for all of northern and north-central Idaho, with the following exception, U.S. Highway 12 between Lewiston and Kamiai and 95 down to Nez Perce is in good condition. Also, U.S. 95 and roads around Grangeville are in good condition, but south and north of there, and including all the Idaho Panhandle, difficult road conditions in Idaho. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website, find out more ways to help KRFP, and you can look for the KRFP end of the year fundraising letter in your pile of mail at your home if we sent one to you. I'm Lee Robartis. Jim Roach and Kurt Morrison assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman Community Radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online.
KRFP Community Radio is proudly supported by Ponderosa Rentals, providing quality home rentals since 2006.